This does constitute a discussion, and we have panelists. They've all been introduced. You introduced them, didn't you?
Yes, let me introduce, all right. Introduce our panelists. Can I take that back from you, Jason? I want to introduce Jason Wren, who is with Geisinger. These are all health systems that you're going to know, familiar with, as part of both the Alliance and the American Hospital Association, and they'll have a chance to, in answering Governor Leavitt's questions, I'm sure, point to specific examples about their organization and let us know a little bit about their organizations. Also with us is Daniel Jorgensen with Care Connect, part of Northwell, and then Phil Jackson with Sutter, and then Terry Klein with Health Alliance Plan, part of Henry Ford System in Detroit.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I would like to tee up a couple of questions, and I'm going to invite all of you. If you have a subject you'd like to discuss, then my job is to make certain that we get discussion. And I want to start by talking about a point that I underscored in my remarks, and that is provider readiness. I proposed or suggested that that may be the most significant barrier or inhibitor to moving to this new system where we could begin to find a blend between our competing values. I'd like to just get a reaction from each of you on the subject of provider readiness. How prepared in your practice area, or in your organization, are providers to begin moving toward this system where we're measuring value, number one? And number two, what do you perceive nationally to be the case? And Jason, you're at the end, but you're also the very well-respected, as the others are, health system. But Geisinger is known for much of what you've been doing in this area. I'd love to hear your reaction to that question.
Great. Thanks, Governor. So Jason Rennie, Geisinger Health Plan. We are a Pennsylvania-based health plan in about 43 counties. We have currently serving close to 600,000 members. Our portfolio is about 200,000, close to 200,000 Medicaid members, about 300,000 commercial members across both fully insured and self-funded, and then about 100,000 Medicare Advantage lives. We, like many systems, I think struggle with the question that's been asked. We've made, I think, some progression over many years around readiness for value. I think the biggest igniters to us getting closer to that readiness path is two things. One is transparency. So the ability to, as everybody here knows, to maximize the power of the data that comes from the health plan level with the data that comes from the clinical enterprise level, not just being able to share that in an intelligent way, but obviously understanding the story and what the data is telling you so that it then becomes actionable across the system. And I think probably the second piece is we have done a lot of work over the past 5 years or so in realigning the way our organization is structured to sort of force a different level of thinking. I heard my Presbyterian colleagues earlier today talk about the fact that they've moved to a global budget structure. So you don't have the health plan in a silo creating sort of their own financial plan separately from the health system. And we've done the same thing. So we operate under a global budget. All of the sort of compensation and incentive packages, both at the health plan level and at the clinical level, have all been modified and adapted in a way where incentives are now aligned towards making sure that we are creating the most value possible to the communities that we serve. And because of the connectivity from a data sharing perspective, we have a very fundamental way of measuring that and tracking it from a report card perspective. So I would say those are the two main things, more sort of infrastructure changes that we've created around how we think about our organization as a global unit. And then, again, the data sharing elements.
Thank you. Daniel?
Yeah, Daniel Jorgensen. I'm with Care Connect. We're a wholly owned subsidiary of Northwell Health. Probably a lot of you all may know us as Northshore LIJ. We just rebranded a couple years ago, so still sinking in. We launched actually in 2014, really in many ways as an answer kind of to the question that you posed, right? So we've got about 120,000 fully insured members, 30,000 on the exchange, or 30,000 individuals, about half of those on the exchange and are therefore subsidized, another 85,000 or so in the small group market, and then the rest are in the large group market. So we've really focused on that fully insured space. And so when we launched in 2014, again, to the question and really what we see as an answer to that question is, you know, the health plan and Care Connect's goal in many ways, the fundamental kind of underlying purpose for its existence is to drive change, you know, inside of Northwell Health, right? To be, to help it become really a risk-bearing entity, right? And that's on a number of, you know, a number of the pieces actually that Jason talked about, right, with data analytics, the infrastructure. But I think really where we're seeing it the most, especially kind of coming out of the gate, you know, still being really in our infancy in many ways, especially as we operate inside the entity, you know, is at the corporate level. And right, how do you drive, you know, how do you align incentives essentially, right, across all of the different entities? As our health system expands and what, you know, in New York City, which is where we operate, you know, in a very competitive market, you know, and as we, you know, move not just into the provider practices, but really try to expand our portfolio into other ancillary areas, you know, how is it that we align our, you know, our lab network, you know, our urgent care network? How do we, you know, pull in our provider practices in many ways, you know, many of whom that, although we purchased it, have, you know, voluntary access to other, you know, other hospital systems that are really big, you know, providers. And often those providers are ones, right, that we need to have as part of our network for our products to be able to sell, while at the same time, you know, possibly running counter to the larger strategic goals of our health system. So in many ways, what the health plan has helped to do is, one, you know, again, kind of shine a light on many of the needs, right, as kind of almost a requirements analysis, you know, but also, you know, again, get the organization into a manner where they're really thinking about, you know, how do we go forward over the next 5 years and using that the health plan and kind of the administrative piece of it, you know, to act as, you know, almost a blanket for tying all these pieces together.
Kitchen. Phil.
Thanks. Phil Jansen. I'm CEO of Health Plan Products at Sutter Health Northern California. I've been there all of 6 months, so it's a little dangerous for me to be up here representing the entire of the organization, but I'll do my best. So my role is to oversee the portfolio of products and services that Sutter prepares, enables to provide better access, more affordable, higher quality access to Sutter Health in Northern California. 25 hospitals, 22 counties, Sacramento, Central Valley, the Bay Area. Our health plan is a commercial HMO product. It's been in existence for 3 years. It's about 65,000 members, serves small group, large group. Within my portfolio is our large self-funded plan, about 100,000 lives within that. And then announced yesterday, day before yesterday, was a new joint venture that we formed, creating an ASO and a fully insured PPO product with the Aetna. In Northern California. So to get to your question about sort of provider readiness, when I think of that, I think about the people actually on the front lines delivering care. So we're blessed in Sutter that we have decades of managed care experience, and a lot of that experience is within the medical foundations and the groups that our foundations contract with. I think like any other medical group that's sort of been through the peaks and valleys of managed care, we've probably got a continuum of expertise, experience, and readiness. We've probably got areas where our muscles have atrophied a little bit. So I think we're going through the process of kind of rebuilding what I would describe as the MSO infrastructure, the reporting and analytics, the care management and disease management infrastructure, because we do see our portfolio of risk lives just continuing to grow. I think we do, and my previous role in another large provider-sponsored plan and delivery system, the plan is that point where you create a dynamic tension. That is the tension of the financing and the delivery of healthcare. And I think it's our responsibility to be a little provocative and to push the envelope and to drive some of the system change. I like the comment earlier about culture eating strategy. You know, like all of you, I'm sure we're on a path. We're probably not as far along as others in terms of the alignment of incentives. I think even physician compensation is a great example of that. We can put all kinds of systems and structures in place, but at the end of the day, what we prioritize, what we capitalize, what we measure, what we reward, what we recognize is what really drives change. So we're getting the pieces in place, but it's there certainly is a sense of urgency to move faster. And I guess I was your mother up sort of comment caught me. I'm not sure when that's going to happen.
So. Important concept. They'll stampede back the other direction. Terry.
I'm Terry Klein. I'm the CEO of HAP, which is the health plan owned by the Henry Ford Health System in Detroit. HAP has been in business for 70-some years. It's been owned by the system for 40 years. For a very long time, we had a completely capitated contract with our delivery system. And some, I don't know, half a dozen years ago or so, that contract was uncapitated, which is exact opposite of the direction we'd all like to be going in. And I think, you know, we now struggle with we find a lot of providers who want to have upside risk. We don't find a lot of providers who want downside risk. It was great when they made money, but when they lose money, it's a bad thing. So part of our network outside of Henry Ford Medical Group is capitated. We have several PHOs that have a lot more risk, and we continue to kind of push with that. And we are working very closely with our own delivery system to find a way to put them back on risk, if nothing more than for RBC calculations at this point in time. As you all know, that taking a provider group of size off risk does a lot to your RBC. So I would say it's a constant struggle. I mean, I think our medical group and our health system got the Malcolm Baldrige Award several years ago. It's not that we can't do hard work. We can do hard work in our system, and we have to figure out a way to apply that same sort of determination to lowering the cost of care, which I think is a lot more of a challenge than improving quality within our system. And so it's a mixed bag, and every day it's a lot of hard work to work with very well-intentioned clinical leaders at figuring out how we change that paradigm to start focusing on lowering the cost of care in a marketplace that does have its own set of social determinants. We're downtown Detroit, so you can imagine that there are some complexities regarding that. But I like to always remind my colleagues when they tell me about that I've been associated with Presbyterian Health Plan for a lot of years, and I don't know if you could find a place that has lower cost of care in a very difficult environment to manage with social determinants. So it's something we have to deal with, but I don't think we can use it as an excuse.
So I'm really pleased that you used the phrase social determinants, because I would like to hear from all of you, but I'd like to engage the rest of you as well on this. I'm hearing it talked about so much, and I'm wondering, is anybody really doing anything yet to begin to integrate these? I'm looking for a raise of a hand in this audience who might have some thoughts about that. Yes. You just use your command voice. The phone people are going.
Yeah, I talked a little bit when I the first day here when I introduced it, and I think we're going to have a couple sessions in August and in October. We're going to talk about it more, but I agree with you. It's a lot of lip service as far as I'm concerned. So, generally ask people what's your budget to address it. There's none, and how many people do you have assigned to it? It's none, and what expertise do you have? It's none. So. Passport, on the other hand, we have a real significant opportunity. We're very lucky we're in this situation. We have 70,000 members in a very concentrated, localized environment, maybe like Detroit, in a tough neighborhood. And those members cost us more than we get paid. And the chronically ill, you name it, it's an issue. So we're actually going to move our office location from the south side of Jefferson County, Kentucky, Louisville, in the middle of that area. I bought 20 acres. We're relocating that, and we're going to have a very thoughtful design about the building, because we're trying to blow up our care model and understand how we take a fragmented health plan and integrate that into the community. So this is a $100 million bet we're making. Yeah. So we're going there.
That sounds like a serious effort.
We actually have a dual eligible program. I don't know how many people in this room have duals programs.
Let's raise your hand. Dually eligible program.
So in the duals program, we do a lot with social determinants, and the only way to not lose your shirt in that program is to really focus on social determinants. So we do a lot with meals, we do a lot with rides in Detroit because of the way the I'm still learning Detroit, but it seems like the roads, the highways just intersect the community in such a way that there's not a lot of good transportation, particularly in the areas. It's a very large metropolitan area, which doesn't have nearly the density of people that it once had. So it, the transportation issues in Detroit are really big, and there's not a very good low-cost primary care delivery system within the city of Detroit. So we have had to work really hard in our duals program at getting people where they can get care. And that's been a big part of dealing with their social determinants.
I was just going to sort of emphasize a point that I think all too often in delivery systems, we tend to think that we can solve all the problems and that we have to control the solution. And I think in social determinants, new models of care, particularly meeting the needs of very vulnerable populations, I think innovation in the care model is paramount, but I think the partnerships, and where I was talking earlier with a couple of other folks, sort of the repurposing of our community benefit programs to be more focused and be able to leverage the investments and the risk that we're taking in the community, I think can go a long way. Partnerships with FQHCs, and we've talked about Meals on Wheels, there's all kinds of things that I think we can do to bolster support and leverage the great work that's already being done in the community just by our engagement and support.
Very interesting.
Yeah, no, I would echo that. And for us, we have a what we call a managed long-term care program, but similar thing, you know, a managed Medicaid program in New York. And we've had a ton of problems with the administration of it, you know, from the state. And that's not to take a shot at New York State by any means, but they've tried to, you know, implement what they call a fully insured dual advantage program, or fully integrated dual advantage program, to pull together kind of that Medicare and Medicaid population into one, and the administration of it has not been good. But, you know, what I would say is the one thing we have seen, you know, especially in a place like New York, where you've got such a diverse population, diverse pockets of all, you know, throughout even just, say, the Brooklyn market itself, you can actually, if we were able to pull that data, right, and kind of look at lessons learned, right, almost treat these things as incubators. The data that we see, right, a lot of the lessons that we learn as a provider could really be shared, right, with other parts of the community, other entities, right, other nonprofits, community-based organizations. In many ways, that data sharing, that knowledge sharing was, you know, had a place to go. You'd see a lot of, you know, a lot of those issues would bubble up that, you know, maybe only we see from our side, and they're only seeing from their end.
Yeah, I always find it interesting how buzzwords and phrases pop up in our industry, and then everybody starts spinning around in circles. I think the reality is all of our organizations for a lot of years have been dealing with social determinants of health. I think that the new buzz that's coming around is certainly leading organizations in different, more aggressive directions. So for us, as an example, like I'm sure many of your geographies, we have addiction issues, significant opioid addiction issues. The state of Pennsylvania is really challenged in that area. So what we've done over the past several years is we've launched opioid clinics, medication-assisted treatment centers, so center of excellence that we brought up in core geographies where the most of the need is in our marketplaces. Those are Geisinger clinics. We've stood up. We staff them. The health plan has developed a global payment methodology to put in place for those clinics to keep them running as efficiently as possible. As you can imagine, once we launched them, the need was so great, and we had lines out the door of people who were trying to get in and get the treatment that we need. So we're looking at adding additional clinics. We're also taking a very aggressive approach in training our primary care providers and getting them certified to care for members who are afflicted by this disease, so that we can use our very robust primary care infrastructure to care for this epidemic as well. We're blessed because we're in a rural area. There's a lot of farms. So we've partnered with a lot of the community farms to develop a healthy food campaign where we are, through both our case management and our disease management program, some of our wellness programs, taking the produce from those farms directly to the consumers of our health plan that need it desperately. So that's another area that we've really stepped up our game recently. In our both our dual-eligible and our Medicaid space, we have developed, like I'm sure many of you have, a special needs unit. That special needs unit is specifically designed to do all the things that we're talking about. It's to work with the community to provide transportation services when needed, to work with the community to get people the services they need that are outside of just medical care. We've actually developed a new, job description within our organization called Community Health Associates. We call them CHAs. And through sort of attrition, if we lose a nurse or some other clinician that's been functioning in our wellness or disease or case management area, we're actually replacing those resources with these community health associates who aren't clinicians, but they're people who are very savvy in understanding the needs of the social needs of the population that we're serving and getting them connected from point A to point B to point C throughout the communities that we're serving. We found that to be very beneficial because not only are we replacing FTEs at a lower dollar value, but we're getting significant value out of those resources. So those are some of the things that we're doing.
So Tom Lundquist with Sentara Health Plans in Virginia. I spoke yesterday about our re-engineering of our case management system, and as we continue our work in Medicaid in Virginia, we've been, like everybody here, talking about social determinants for many years. But the new managed long-term care and services support contract that we're about to start August 1 had a lot of very forward-thinking requirements and a lot of the need to capture social determinants and then most importantly, share that information with anybody on the care team, and that can include a lot of the community providers. So with our partners on our reengineering of our system, we're baking that into the workflows, and we're capturing that data. We'll be able to share it with all members of the care team, including community providers, and they'll have access into that same system for communication. So I think the real crux of that social determinants piece is how do you get everybody focused on the same need so that you don't duplicate effort or, worse, drop the ball entirely. So we believe we have a system that's going to help us do that really quite uniquely.
Very interesting. Can I just say, I believe that what is going to and is changing the nature of this discussion is fully capitated risk. States who have borne the risk of Medicaid, for example, and the dually eligibles, have had a whole series of other programs that have served the same population, but they've had individual budgets, and when they're exhausted, they're done and their job is finished. When you capitate risk and suddenly someone has to be caring for the entire health span and they begin to see these other categories that are affecting them, I believe they're going to raise their hand and say to the state, if we had some influence on that, it would help us and it would clearly help you. So a story. I'm governor and a relatively small state. Small enough that we had quite intimate contact with the people we served. And it became very clear to me that you could create lists of families that we would be serving in 5 or 6 different agencies or departments, and you could predict by the time they're 6 or 7 years old who we were going to see in the juvenile courts, who it was we were going to see in alternative schools. And so we began to create a very rudimentary and I would say inefficient system. We would get the leaders of the various practice areas together and we would sit down and I wasn't involved, but I know they were actually doing this. This was part of the design. Put a name of a family on the table and let's see who is serving them and what are you doing. And it turns out that the 5 or 6 caregivers are not aware of any of what the others are doing. And so to me, that's the reason I think we're going to start seeing Medicaid and to some extent Medicare Advantage begin to look for ways in which they can not just assume some interest in the social determinants, they're going to say to the state, give us some of your money in the TANF program. Give us some of your money in the vocational education area. Give us some of your money in the nutrition programs and let us manage that together. Maybe it'll be one contract, or maybe it will be an alliance. Now, I'm involved in three different settings right now where we're attempting, we're not there yet, but we're attempting to establish two zip code areas where we will actually try to bring an alliance of all of the players together who will have influence on this and beginning to create a more technologically enabled version of that table. But what's bringing it together? Capitated risk. I'm of the view that you really don't get any integration until risk is present. Risk clarifies responsibility. And that's when people begin to look for new ways of disrupting care. React to that.
So I would agree with that. In our state, we have been having discussions for 6 months now with our legislature around integrating behavioral health and physical health in the Medicaid population, something that doesn't exist in our state today. And it's driving some very negative behavior and some very positive behavior, dependent upon whether or not you see your cheese being moved positively or negatively. And there's a great deal of lobbying going on against doing this, so much so that there's been kind of a pause. And just recently, we've been told that they were going to move forward with a pilot to look at how we can start structuring some significant pilots around the integration, which I think will change our behavioral health system in Michigan, which is incredibly broken. So I'm hopeful.
Phil?
Yeah, I think the capitation drives behavior change, and I think it drives innovation. I think when you're talking about, you know, telehealth years ago, there were things that, you know, people wanted to implement, saw a lower, less expensive level of care, provided better access, wasn't reimbursed under a classic fee-for-service model, so adoption was very slow. New community health workers, a great example as well. I mean, you sort of can run down the list of, I think, innovation that's occurred in healthcare that we've had trouble spreading as a result of the fee-for-service system that you very accurately described as probably the bane of our existence. Capitation drives an opportunity for us to innovate and to innovate and adapt much more quickly than in the current fee-for-service environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're actually talking about is something that's probably occurred in many ways over time through education policy for children, right? Schools have been a normal place where you've seen a lot, especially when we talk about behavioral health, right? You know, children's health services have actually been accessed. Children have been accessed in many ways through the education system for years. You know, and it's interesting that, you know, capitation is actually finally providing that incentive more for the adult population at this point. So I think really when it comes to the states and the need for really forward-thinking leaders and, you know, and politicians, it's how do you start, right? You have these kind of pockets at this point, right, of going back to social determinants or the answer to social determinants. It's occurring in certain policy groups, right? But even getting beyond healthcare, right, you're kind of building up to this stage of how do you again layer on a piece of taking all these different policy groups and then the funding that naturally underlies it, right, and create an incentive structure that you know, that allows that doesn't put in place essentially a system where everyone's fighting for the same dollars. You know, even, I mean, I think we'd agree that our health system in many ways may be better served to take some of the dollars away from other community-based organizations to you know, to serve the populations we're embedded with us, but at the same time, we're still taking, you know, there's still only kind of a finite pot that we're all pulling from. You know, I think there's a larger solution that has to be asked for.
I mean, in the 35 years that the Geisinger Health Plan has been in existence, the Geisinger Health System's been in existence for 100 years. And so when the health plan came along and intersected, and over that course of the past 35 years, we've had multiple iterations of cap models, partial cap models, upside risk, downside risk relationships, fee-for-service. So we've gone all across the entire continuum. I think what we've found is that downside risk, when done appropriately and correctly, is the best way that we've found, at least in our geography, to change behavior of clinicians. Because, again, it creates an incentive, again, when I say done correctly, meaning you have to have that transparency. You have to be able to provide information and data to the provider to help them understand how they're doing in managing the care. You have to be able to provide them information that's sort of a peer-to-peer evaluation of how they're doing against their own peer clinicians in the community as far as their ordering patterns, as far as their referral patterns, as far as making very intelligent decisions about where to send people for care. So it's one thing to write a contract that says, okay, we're going to send this bucket of money over the fence, and it's your problem now. It's a whole another thing to develop that financial connection, but then provide the information that makes it meaningful. So I think that's a really important piece to what we've been able to do at the Geisinger organization.
Comments? Social determinants? Yes.
Thank you. I really like your idea of capitated organizations perhaps drawing down on some of the social service spending and having better coordination. But it seems like to date, the idea hasn't been that health plans or providers would get more money, but the expectation is that they would do this work out of their existing payment. So I'm just curious, and I guess it's probably for everyone in the room, I don't think that conversation is really happening at the federal level, but are there states that are actually talking about or willing to direct more resources or divert, from other social service providers to health plans and providers right now? Or is it more the experience that the expectation or the rates are sufficient and they'd rather have a shift in how much is going towards medical spending over to social service spending, and they're sort of expecting these capitated provider plans or other plans to make that shift?
Great
for
question.
Them?
Anybody want to respond to that? I will say that the one area I've begun to see it is in behavioral health, where people are more willing to aggregate behavioral health with physical health, as was referenced. And I personally believe that this is still it's going to be, has not yet occurred in large amounts, but it is going to occur as states take on more responsibility. Phil.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know if Kelly Kaiser is still here from Samaritan, but the CCO model in Oregon is a great example of where they brought behavioral health back in, they brought dental in. It's a community-based risk relationship, so it's less plan-specific or provider-specific. So you find the Medicaid population in a county served by virtually all the providers in the county under one risk pool. And so you've got behavioral health, you've got the dental providers, you've got the hospitals and the medical groups all participating in the conversation. Now, I know they're connecting with other social service agencies, but I don't believe at this point, nor have I heard anywhere else in the country at this stage of the game, where the social service funds are in that capitated amount, although I think there have been efforts to move in that direction in some waiver requests.
Kathy.
I think for some of the programs that were developed, not so much in Medicaid, but if you think about like the Care More model, California, they developed that on their own. They did all this wraparound of services to care for the frail elderly, and because they were able to reduce hospitalizations by about 50%, they just reallocated some of that money into the social service bucket, and that was sort of self-motivated. I think if you think about, well, we just need more money to do this versus what's the most effective way to use the money that we have, you might not get there. You're looking for add-ons. So there are areas and examples where they've reallocated. I think housing is another one, especially where you have homeless. There was an example in Boston where a homeless, if you're discharged from the hospital, you're more likely to go back in pretty soon, because if you need a bed to recover in, you have to stand in line at the homeless shelter, and you may or may not get a bed. So one of the organizations repurposed a building as a step-down unit for the homeless to recover once they'd been discharged, so it wouldn't put them back out on the street. So I think it's rethinking the overall way in which dollars are used and how those get put together. One other comment, too, about the social services, when you say, well, if you give us the money, from having done work in community health before, giving more money sometimes to the traditional medical services doesn't improve the outlink to the community, because they know how to do things on a very limited budget, but it's like plugging them into the mainstream of the care continuum, and maybe the funding source is different, but their expertise level is something that often doesn't exist in the traditional medical sphere. And so it's more of a partnership or collaboration than it is a replacement or a funding issue.
We should go to that, Peter, and yeah. Then I want...
Uh, I just wanted to say, I know California, when they went up for the 1115 waiver, I want to say about 2 years ago, proposed a portion of money to go after social determinants. And unfortunately, it was something that didn't make it through the negotiation with the federal government. But I want to say it was somewhere around $1 or $2 billion that they were hoping to have as a block that they could tackle some of those issues. So I don't know if you can Google kind of what the original proposal was that was filed, but they did have a section that really did try to address that.
Anyone from Iowa here? So I would point to Iowa as one place to look, because the Department of Human Services, and which Medicaid is part of, is now working to develop a more integrated approach to this. And my sense is that this will take place in one of two ways. The first is that someone will come to the state and say, you have behavioral health. In this particular area, we would like to pilot taking responsibility for the delivery of behavioral health as an add-on, and we want it to come from this budget, and we'll contract under a separate capitated amount. I think it'll clearly start as a pilot. The second area that I think is starting to develop, and three of the things that I was mentioning that we're beginning to form in these two zip code areas, is a true alliance. Kathy's been kind to give you all a copy of a book called Finding Allies, Building Alliances. You are part of an alliance. But in these alliances, essentially it is a group of organizations who get together and through a collaborative process form an organization where they use their respective resources to do what was talked about at that table, where each of the care, but I think we'll start to see technology-enhanced collaborative alliances that are happening in specific areas to learn how to do this. And then there will be steps that'll come after that. But clearly, if the social determinants are in fact impacting the health spend, if you're taking capitated risk, you're going to have to get to that, I think. All right, any other comments on that subject? Yes.
Hi, just a quick comment. Emily Leach, also from Care Connect. I just want to throw in there that when we talk about social determinants, the focus is often on Medicaid and Medicare and where the government dollars are, and the government dollars are paying for it. But especially, you know, I'm the commercial world, so I think commercial too, but I think it's a real challenge to think how you wrap that into the commercial world, especially when you look at even the exchange products and sort of where people are on the sort of federal poverty level down to that are still in the commercial products. It's just an important piece to continue struggling with and thinking about how you address it in the commercial world too, where the dollars are not the government spend.
Very useful.
You know, one of the things that happened with the Affordable Care Act in H 26 is that there are a lot more schizophrenics in commercial populations today than there used to be. And actually, those are people who frequently end up with a lot of social determinants, which might have resulted from their health status or might not have caused it, but it's still the application of the same kind of principles that we have to do with them. And they're in the commercial population today.
Go ahead.
Again, Tom Lundquist from Sentara. In Virginia and Medicaid, one of the things that's really interesting in behavioral health is there's a new CMO that the state hired for Medicaid a little over a year ago, and Kate Newhousen has done a great job with a number of colleagues in the state to raise the rates that Medicaid is going to pay behavioral health services. In some cases, over 400% more than traditionally has been done. That's a game changer, because a lot of providers, including our own system, had stayed out of certain behavioral health services because the reimbursement just didn't make any sense. And what she has effectively done, at least as the tip of this spear, is get a lot of health systems from across the state to rethink whether or not they should be in behavioral health, inpatient, outpatient, and other. And, of course, part of this is being driven by the opioid crisis, which many states are facing. We certainly are in Virginia. So that was part of her impetus. But even prior to that becoming in the public sector, she was already looking at behavioral health as a social determinant and knew that she needed to help change the payment structure to get more services delivered. So really exciting things coming on in Virginia, and I think it's certainly worth keeping an eye on. We're very much at the table with her.
That's a very good thing to know. You raised your hand. Were you signaling for a microphone? Great.
Hi, April Vogelsang with Health Alliance Medical Plans here in Illinois. One thing I have not heard anyone mention, surprisingly, is just the increased number of felons seeking health care services. And I think that in our particular, you know, instance, the biggest struggle is getting those that are in an inpatient setting transferred to a lower, lesser care, level of care, particularly in a skilled nursing facility or a long-term care center, because of all of the rules and regulations and licensure requirements around that that really prohibit that for patients that may have had something happen 30, 40 years ago in their past that now follows them, and having trouble getting members and patients into a lower level of care when it's appropriate. And I didn't know if anyone had any ideas on how they're tackling that, but we've actually contacted some state legislatures to see if we can have some impact on maybe changing some of those rules around that, because it seems, you know, I mean, we had an instance of a patient that was quadriplegic, and we couldn't get him into a long-term care facility because he had a prior criminal record and obviously could not harm or do something to hurt someone else. So it's just those regulations and rules that seem to also be impacting the transitions of care.
Very interesting question. Any of the panelists have experience with felons and their health care? Yes. Tom, you've got some good experience.
I actually may know that patient from having handled the correctional health care contracts in Illinois with a company for a lot of years. So I actually spent 5 years in correctional health care, working for a dozen different states during my time there. There is a huge disconnect in the fact that we carve out our incarcerated populations from the general mainstream of health care. It made no sense to me while I was in the industry that when a convicted felon, actually someone's in the jails or when they're convicted and they are incarcerated, that they get removed from the normal health care rosters. They lose any state benefits they get. But they then get paid state benefits while they're in corrections. And they actually get remarkably great health care, believe it or not, in most cases, more often than not. So the disconnect, but it's more expensive, it's behind bars, and it's we have to develop all new networks. So there is the political area around this is incredibly challenging. Both Republican and Democrats in multiple states would always say, just keep us out of the papers. Don't be too good, and don't be bad. No politicians wanted this on the forefront of their, you know, their politics as they were trying to get elected. Yet the cost is extraordinary, and the transitions are horrid. I often would have public health officials say, when we were trying to transfer somebody out and try to make arrangements, we can't handle them while they're there. Give them the phone number, and we'll take care of them. You know, have them call us. Well, we know many are going to fall out, you know, by the wayside. So there's a huge disconnect. It's highly costly to every state, and I would love to see that addressed, and I'd be happy to partner with whoever was doing it, given my experience, to try to help solve for that.
Interesting comment. So I'd like to turn back to the panel, and kind of moving toward the end of our time, I'd like to have each of you think a bit about what is it that in the current political environment we're in worries you the most? And then if there's something that makes you feel optimistic, I'd like to have you reflect on that, too. Anybody care to jump out at either of those? Phil?
Well, it's kind of an odd response to the question. I guess what feels good, what feels certain, is the fact that, you know, and you said this in your presentation, we have to get our hands around the value proposition, the value for each dollar spent in healthcare, because we do an awful job of demonstrating value to the consumer, to the purchaser of healthcare. And I don't know how long we've been on that journey, but regardless of all the uncertainty that's out there, that remains, to get to your point, that is true north. I mean, the total cost of care, the value, is what this is all about. And regardless of what political questions and conversations and decisions are being made, that remains a focus that we just cannot let go of. And so in the midst of ambiguity, that certainty anchors me, and I think it anchors our organization as well.
A great comment.
Yeah, I would say for us, I mean, to the first half of your question, what scares me, I mean, we're in the business of risk, right? And so the uncertainty combined with the fact that the government, right, is a, you know, is an entity that's a reimbursement entity is becoming more and more part of the day-to-day, you know, healthcare experience of everyone, right? Now we have the individuals on the market. In New York, we've, you know, added this layer between what we call the essential benefit plan, but between the Medicaid population and the fully insured population. The uncertainty that comes with, you know, that comes with the government being the main provider of the reimbursement is naturally a problem. On the flip side for us, and I think what we, especially as a narrow network product in New York, have seen, I think is really positive, is you're seeing a real change in consumer purchasing habits, right? The fact that we always say a narrow network was, you know, formerly a four-letter word, right, where we all came from, and now people are seeing that, you know, the fact that there is this uncertainty out there is driving, you know, different different options from consumers. The fact that we're even all the back and forth in the media, right, for the on the political side, actually brings, you know, to the forefront another level of education, another level of dialogue around the healthcare market. And for us, I think that in many ways leads to a more educated consumer and opens their eyes rather, you know, to all the different options and helps us innovate as well.
Yeah, I think the logical answer is, you know, over the past decade, at least within my organization, we've had a huge shift of dependency on government program reimbursement. 10 years ago, we were a heavily penetrated commercial plan with relatively small dependency on government programs, and that's completely flipped. So, I mean, naturally, I think we would all say, you know, decreases in the premium dollar from the government is a challenge, and it keeps us awake at night. But I put a different spin on it. I'm not so much concerned about the premium dollar coming down as to what the governor was talking about before. There's got to be more to it than that. So if reimbursement's going to decline to managed care organizations in the government program sector, with that has to be broader efficiencies created through less bureaucracy, more control at the managed care plan level, a lot of the restrictions that occur. Just, you guys know what I'm talking about, all the regulatory stuff that is piled on to running managed care programs in the government sector. Relief from that sort of pays for the reduction in the premiums, and it allows organizations like all of ours in the room to run much more efficiently. And I think that's my concern, is I don't see the, you talked about more flexibility, both at the federal and state level. I just don't see that being reciprocated now. I see payments coming down, but the increased flexibility is not happening.
So hope is alive.
Yes. So the thing that excites me most is the advances that are taking place in actual healthcare delivery, the new technologies we have, the advances we have in drugs, and what they could do for our health status. And what really frightens me a bit is how we afford those and how we make sure that we're taking older technologies out of the system and not just duplicating old technologies along with the new advanced technologies. Because I think some of the things we're looking at with the human genome and all will just make our ability to laser in care much more effective, and we need to make sure that we're taking all the waste out of the system to allow us to do that.
So I would like to just answer the question myself in our conclusion today. I would tell you that I am feeling more optimism right now about healthcare than I have for a long time. And that may seem odd. But the reason for it is that I am beginning to see people do hard things, very hard things that they intuitively would not do, but that the economic imperative is driving them to do it. I'm seeing people combine practices. I'm seeing all kinds of new innovations occur. Is it going to take time? Yes. It has to take time. We're talking about the transformation of literally 20% of the entire economy of the United States. You can't see a system of that size in America, whether it's transportation or communication or any other major system, that has taken less time than that, and I'm beginning to see people do hard things. There's another thing that makes me optimistic, and I want to just show you a picture. I don't know if you, I guess it's turned on. You'll, as that begins to brighten, you'll see that it's a picture that I took in Athens, or at Olympia, Greece, in 2002. We had the Olympic Games in Utah, and I was governor at the time, and so I had a chance to go to Olympia, Greece, to see the lighting of the Olympic flame. So it's a long ways from here, and we traveled a day and a night, and we got to this little town of Olympia where the original Olympics were. We went out to the original site, and these eight women and a young man walked out of the trees that you'll see are behind there in a very quiet, dignified, traditional ceremony. And one of them, as you can see, held a torch. And there was on the ground a metal bowl. And she took the some flammable material and put in the bottom of the metal bowl. And because it was a hot day, the sun began to shine on that metal bowl, and there was heat generated. And suddenly you began to see some smoke, and then there was this audible sound of whoosh, and there was a flame. And it was the first moment that I realized after many years of preparation that the Olympic flame is actually the sun. So the woman took her torch and dipped it into this flame and then held it in a salute. And from the woods there came another runner. This one was dressed in the uniform of the Utah Winter Olympic Games, and it was a moment where a lot of cold chills occurred in the governor's spine. But he ran out and held up the torch of the Winter Games, and the two torches touched, and there was this whoosh. And then he held it high in a salute, and he began to run. And it was the beginning leg of that Olympic torch run that goes from country to country and then state to state and town to town, and some of you may have actually seen it. And I was fascinated by the fact that everywhere this torch run went, there were tens of thousands of people who would turn out on the side of the road to see, essentially, fire on a stick. And I said to the woman who was organizing it, I don't get this. What is it that causes people to come out and salute fire on a stick? She said, you really don't get this, do you? Let me explain it to you. 2 weeks ago, she said, I was out on the torch run. I had a gap in the runners, and I sent my assistant ahead to find a runner. She apparently ran into a school and found the school secretary and said, I've got a gap in the runners, and I need a runner in the torch relay. Don't give me the principal, and I don't want the student body president. Give me somebody who needs a bit of a lift. And the school secretary said, I know just the little boy. And about 5 minutes later, she said, we were dressing up this undersized fifth grader in the uniform of the Olympic Games. And the runner approached from the torch run. And the two torches came close. There was a flame. The little boy sort of held up the torch with both hands and began to run. And there, like every other place, there were tens of thousands of people that were lining the streets. And he approached the school, and his classmates were on the front lawn, and they cheered him. She said, I got an email from the school secretary who thanked me for coming and asking them to participate. And then she said of the little undersized fifth grader, he doesn't sit alone anymore. She said, that is the power of the fire on the stick. It isn't about athletics, and it's not about business models. It's about the capacity of people to do what's right for humanity, to be able to become better and to be stronger and to reach out to care for each other. I tell you that story because we're here talking about a lot of business models and hard things, but the reality is the fire on the stick isn't any of that. The fire on the stick is the ability to care for people and to live in a country where there is, in fact, this sense of basic ethos that we want to take care of each other. And we're all lucky to work, to both live in this country where it's possible and to work in this industry where it's essential. And I just want to challenge all of you that as you go throughout the course of this day and return to your place of work, that let's remember the fire on a stick is that sense of compassion that makes our country a great place. Thank you. Thanks to the panel.